I imagined myself lying there, staring into the distance, drawing my last breaths. This was a loud wake-up call. I needed no further encouragement. The shock and trauma of this experience made me look at my life through fresh new eyes. I had too much to live for. I didn't know it at the time, but her death was going to save my life. Her passing became the platform for a turnaround in my own health. I began to modify my diet, exercise more, research more, and pay more attention to the fact that my body had suffered cancer. I had focused all my energy on infertility, but now I no longer tried to brush the disease under the carpet as if it had never existed. I knew my health demanded my full attention, that cancer was a lesson to which I had so far refused to listen. I had to reduce my sugar levels, at the very least, so I cut out many simple carbohydrates like bread and sugar, although at this stage I didn't take it far enough. And I removed dairy and most meat, which both contain the IGF-1 hormones that drive cancer growth. I rarely ate red meat anyway, but now I cut out foods I found inflammatory, such as potatoes, tomatoes, rhubarb, grapefruit, and strawberries. I felt these were too acidic, and they seemed to stimulate an inflammatory reaction in my body. I could tell. I'd just been through a knee operation for the ski accident, and my joint would make it clear the next day if I'd made a dietary error. Inflammation seemed to be a driving force for cancer, and if what I ate sparked inflammation in my knee, might it spark further cancer? To monitor my diet this carefully meant paying close attention to how food affected me, whether I felt tired afterwards, whether I was bloated or had joint pain. I eliminated foods and made lists of everything I'd been eating to try to work out which foods didn't agree with me. It was very much trial and error, and it took some time to sort out which foods were a problem. Today, tests exist to detect IgG antibodies, so the offending foods are easily identified. This is far simpler than this hit-or-miss approach, which was time-consuming and inaccurate. Wheat and dairy, it appeared, were the worst offenders. I swapped normal tea for green tea and began juicing. I cut right back on alcohol and started popping more supplements. If the cancer came back, I sure as hell was going to be prepared. I was already hoofing glucosamine supplements for my knee, but I increased my intake of vitamin C and other vitamins. The glucosamine sulfate, it turned out, was a good thing. It's a great prebiotic, excellent for maintaining a healthy gut, a fact that is still largely unknown. And I was to discover it is also a matrix metalloproteinase inhibitor. More on this later. But in short, it helps halt progression. But I realize with the benefit of hindsight that I may have fueled my disease by taking oral vitamin C and vitamin E. I had assumed by taking these I was preventing a metastasis, where the cancer sends out a mass of little satellite cells and strikes in a new zone of the body. What I had yet to learn was that supplements for cancer prevention were totally different to those you need when you already have cancer. The assumption I had beaten it would turn out to be entirely wrong. By the end of 1998, I started to get a nagging cough. I'm not the kind of patient who runs to the doctor at the merest tickle, but I was worried. I knew enough about my cancer now to know the lungs were the most likely place for it to spread. So naturally, I found this new complaint extremely stressful. I was on high alert. The doctor told me I had a chest infection, that was all, but one round of antibiotics failed to clear it. I tried another course, which again failed, so I decided to adopt the tactic of waiting for it to clear by itself. It didn't. Every time I went back to the doctor, I was prescribed another round of antibiotics, and another bug would be revealed, as if I were peeling back the layers on an onion, one infection hiding another. 2 months later, I was still coughing badly. No longer content to accept it was just another infection, I went back to the doctor and asked for an urgent X-ray. My GP duly obliged, and that afternoon I walked up the road to the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital's radiology department, my X-ray request clutched in my hand, with trepidation about what it would reveal. I told the radiographer I'd been treated for cancer already, and that I feared it might have spread. I asked if she could please take a lateral X-ray too, as the GP had put only one view on the request form. A lateral view is side to side. Another angle helps rule out anything suspicious. About 30 minutes later, she came out smiling, saying it had been looked at and there was nothing to worry about. It all looked perfectly clear and a lateral view was not needed. Phew, I really should try to stop worrying, I told myself. I was behaving like a typical cancer patient, getting anxious over every niggle and ache. But I had been let down by tests before. Another 2 months on and the cough was still coming and going. My nagging doubt continued to grow. I'd started legal proceedings against the first gynaecologist and the South London Hospital, and my trust in the medical profession was at an all-time low. Why had my lungs suddenly started giving me all this trouble, and why couldn't it be fixed with antibiotics? I was constantly dismissed as a worrier by the surgery. Then one Sunday afternoon in August, after a coughing fit, I tasted blood in my mouth. Whoa, had it really been blood? I said nothing to Andrew but quietly took myself upstairs to cough into the basin in the bathroom. Right in front of me, as clear as day, was a big streak of blood. Oh God, could this mean anything else? I sat on the edge of the bed trying not to panic. Think, Jane, had I eaten something that had scratched my throat? I coughed again, and there it was. Even more blood. Shit, shit, shit! I called Andrew upstairs. He stared at the blood, but somehow remained calm. Perhaps he didn't quite understand. Even after I explained the seriousness of what he was looking at, still an expressionless face. He would be great at poker. Often, I found his outward lack of emotion irritating, but in a time of crisis like this, his logical, calm, and practical approach was incredibly useful. We sat there, trying to figure out the best course of action. Where should we go? I could no longer trust the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I had a suspicion my X-ray there had not been read correctly. We decided to head back to the Hammersmith Hospital, where I'd had all my previous treatments in 1994-5. It was a longer drive, and I would have done anything to avoid ever entering that hospital again. The memories and the trauma of it all had left me with a deep-seated fear and loathing of the place. Reluctantly, we headed back to the grim, dilapidated building, the Hammer House of Horror. In accident and emergency that Sunday evening, the staff were trying to deal with hordes of demanding and angry patients. An elderly man who clearly had a lot to drink had accidentally cut his finger off. He was charging about, shouting and accusing everyone of being useless, his finger in a bag of ice. Perhaps they were being useless, hard to tell. Someone surely should get him into surgery straight away. The blood kept coming to my mouth every time I coughed. How long would we have to wait? After about an hour, we were seen by a young and nervous junior doctor who led us into a cubicle. He asked the usual medical history questions, then tried every vein he could find in my arms and hands to get a blood sample. He was about to move down to try my feet when I suggested someone else should maybe have a go. Andrew has never been very good with blood and needles, and he had to leave the cubicle as he was feeling faint. Man up, I teased through the curtain. I was feeling like a pincushion. After that, I was sent for an X-ray. I was still telling myself it must have been something rough I'd eaten at lunch. But the blood was still there. It hadn't stopped. It had got worse. As my business advisor used to tell me, there is nothing worth worrying about unless you're going to die. And if you're going to die, there's no point worrying. A mantra that somehow didn't fit the context of illness, where the real possibility of pain and suffering lay ahead. But I decided he was right. I'd stay calm and positive until we knew exactly what we were dealing with, if anything. Stay in the present, Jane. Deep, slow, calm breaths. I made sure the radiographer took both the posterior anterior, back front, as well as a lateral view. Then Andrew and I sat down and waited. A junior doctor came out to see us. He looked seriously concerned. "I just have to get someone else to check this," he said. Fine, I wanted it checked properly. Even if he came back saying it was clear, I was going to get a copy and at least another opinion. I wanted to be 100% sure there was nothing there. I had lost faith in relying on one voice on anything to do with cancer. We started leafing through magazines and tried not to think about it too much. Still, we occasionally addressed the question, what if? I braced myself for any bad news and decided whatever the outcome, I was now knowledgeable enough about stage 4 cancer that I was at least going to be able to have a go at beating it. Knowing where to start digging for information was something I had already tackled. I had a head start. We waited and waited. A couple of hours passed. Okay, this is normal for a busy outpatient department, I said to myself. It was just typical NHS. Too many patients, too few staff. It was now about 9 o'clock in the evening, and Andrew was getting peckish. I was too worried to eat, and I didn't want him to wander off and leave me on my own in case we were called. We sat there trying to stay upbeat. But the staff on the desk were acting strangely. It looked as if they were quietly talking about us. I told myself I was imagining it and tried to ignore them. Why were they taking so long? Where were they? I already knew the answer, but I continued to deny it to myself. Finally, a doctor made his way over and asked us into a side room. I held Andrew's hand and squeezed it. We looked at each other and silently acknowledged that this was not a good sign. If the X-ray had been all clear, we would have been sent on our way ages ago, not being made to wait, and then pulled in here. I took a deep breath and summoned up every ounce of bravery I could muster. Once inside, I perched on the edge of the bed, trying my best to act normally. He shut the door and came straight out with it. Unfortunately, it appears there is a shadow in your right lung. I already knew. He stuck the X-ray up on the viewer and showed us the slightly irregular round lump in my right lung. Yes, there it was. Cancer. It had come back, and I knew without him saying so that I was now stage 4, so-called terminal or incurable. Try to stay calm, Jane. Looking down, I saw my hands were shaking uncontrollably. How many tumours can you see? I asked, my voice quite composed, despite the turbulent emotions inside me.
Well, we can't be sure it's a tumour. We need the results of the blood test to be sure, and a biopsy, of course, he said.
Look, I'm a physiotherapist, and I know it's almost certain to be a tumour. I've had cervical cancer. The most likely place for a secondary is in the lungs, and now I'm coughing up blood with a shadow right there. Please be honest with me. The chance of it being anything else is extremely remote. How many tumours can you see?
The doctor looked at me silently for a few seconds and realized there was little point trying to fudge the information as they normally do, or to break the news gently in half-truths, not being completely honest with the seriousness of the situation. Well, yes, it is most likely a tumour, but the good news, if there is any, is that it looks like there's just the one, although it is bigger than a golf ball. The bad news is I'm afraid you're going to have to stay in hospital. We're worried you might need emergency surgery if a major vessel bursts, so we've arranged a bed in one of the wards.
Whoa. Okay. That hit me like a punch on the nose. They thought I might be close to popping my clogs at any moment. Shit. Andrew looked at me and I murmured, I'm going to be all right, don't worry. I'm sure they're just being overcautious. Although I really had no idea if they were.
It may seem strange that here I was just diagnosed with terminal cancer, and I was taking it far better than 5 years earlier. Losing my womb, my woman.